Okay, so for the past couple of weeks, again, we've been looking at what I call contrasts between the traditional interpretation application of the law as taught by the scribes and Pharisees, put in effect by the scribe, or applied by the scribes and Pharisees, and Jesus' clarification of the meaning. That's not necessarily all of the areas in which they were differed in their application and their interpretation. I think there's maybe some of the more pertinent ones that Jesus saw that they were, that the people that were there hearing him on that day were dealing with or saw happening daily or in their lives. But the principle and the application that we can take from them is also there. Last week we talked about eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, how that had started out as, and originally was intended by God as, guidance for judges in determining a proper punishment for something that had happened. If we look back at Exodus chapter 21, we see that when it says that there's two men fighting, and in the course of their fight, a woman who's pregnant is caused to go into labor, the baby is born. If there's no harm, and this is what the passage says, if there's no harm, then whatever the woman's husband assesses is what the penalty is. But if there's harm, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, fracture for fracture, wound for wound, that's where that kind of came in, is when there's a harm done. So as Jesus says here in the Sermon on the Mount, you've heard it said, eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. Well, again, it started out as that's what a judge was supposed to use as guidelines, if you will, direction on his assigning of a punishment. And it had kind of devolved, if you want to use that word, into what personal retribution can I take? I believe that's what happened because Jesus says, don't resist an evil person. Immediately after that. And he uses four examples. Now, last week we talked a little bit in depth about those examples, but if you look at it, really, what do we have? A slap on the cheek, somebody taking your tunic in court, somebody being compelled to walk an extra mile, someone who's asking for something. It goes on to describe kind of borrow. Again, that could be your ox, it could be money, it could be whatever. If you think about it, there's four assaults listed. The first one, the slap, could be an assault on your pride, considering that the slap on the right cheek with the right hand, that's a backhand. That's sort of an insult more than a harm. It may hurt. You know, if you slap somebody hard enough, you could, you know, leave a mark. You could, it could hurt, but not necessarily break out teeth, break out, you know, break the jaw, those kinds of things. So there's not really a harm done, even if there's a hurt done. Could also be considered a physical assault, obviously, slapping somebody. The next one, taking your tunic, that would be an assault on your property. Somebody's taking stuff of yours. The third one, compelling somebody to walk a mile, you're assaulting time and energy. Somebody's saying, you've got to go here with me. Now, if you happen to be going that way anyway, it's probably not so much on your time because you're going that way anyway. But if you just come from that direction and now they say, okay, you've got to go back a mile with me, okay, that's an assault on your time, and you're carrying something, that's an assault on your energy. And giving to someone who asks, that could be considered an assault on your finances, whether that's actual, you know, money out of your pocket, or grain, or an, you know, you can't use your ox because you've lent it to somebody else. So those are kind of different assaults. And what Jesus has said is, the common perception is, how can I retaliate? What revenge can I take? And he's saying, don't. Don't retaliate. And then you ask yourself, why wouldn't you want to retaliate? If somebody slaps you, and you turn around and punch them, what has that done? It's escalated the conflict. It's made things worse. And when Jesus specifically says, don't resist an evil person, a kind person, first of all, probably wouldn't assault you in these different ways, but an evil person, if you retaliate against them, they are going to, you know, up the ante against you. As we talked about last week, you know, a slap turns into a punch, turns into a whole village being slaughtered through the escalation of violence. So that was what Jesus talked about last week. We, as Christians, and the people that Jesus was talking to there, he wanted them to think differently than what was the current way of thinking. The current way of thinking was, hey, somebody does something to me, I'm going to do it right back to them. He wants them to think different. He wants us to think differently. If you look at Romans chapter 12, verse 1, what would Paul say? Don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Think differently than the world does. What's our world all about? They blew up our building. We're going to go blow up their town. The same thing on a grander scale or a larger scale. Jesus is saying we shouldn't think like that. As Christians, we shouldn't have that attitude. And ultimately, and I didn't get to it last week as I was hoping to, ultimately I think the answer to how can we do that, how can we fight that urge to retaliate, is found in the next section. Jesus says, starting in verse 43 of Matthew chapter 5, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Wait, how many people know the passage where it says hate your enemy? How many people have read that passage? Ed, have you read that passage anywhere? No, neither have I. We can find a lot of places where it says to love your neighbor. Specifically, in the law, in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, Jesus says, love your enemy. Well, Jesus didn't say it. God said it by the Spirit through Moses. It says, you shall not take vengeance or bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Ah, the caveat of our people. We have to love our people, but not all the rest of the people. That seems to be the implication, the way of thinking that these people had. Hate your enemy is not found anywhere. Specifically in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 17, so the previous verse says, you shall not hate your brother. Okay, so I can't hate my brother. Well, who's my brother? We've already talked about that a little bit earlier in the class sessions. Our brother is more than just our blood kin. I believe in Leviticus, he was talking about other Israelites. But it could be extended beyond that. He says, you should rebuke your neighbor, but don't bear sin because of him. Do those passages about don't hate your brother, love your neighbor, and don't bear grudge against the children of Israel, against the children of your people, does that mean it's okay to hate our enemies? In Psalm chapter 97, verse 10, we read, you who love the Lord, hate evil. And in Amos chapter 5, verse 15, Amos, the prophet, says, hate evil, love good. So we have a question, is it okay to hate our enemy? And I wonder, I speculate, again, this is Dave's speculation based on what he has read. Did the scribes, did the Pharisees, did the rabbis, over time, as they tried to understand and interpret what God had said, take hate evil, can't hate your brother, can't hate other people in Israel, hate evil to hate the evildoer. And that concept today, if we think about it, how does God feel about sin? He hates it. How does God feel about sinners? He loves them. How much? He gave his son. So what's the difference between hate sin, love sinners, and hate evil? Where's the evildoer? Kind of a parallel. And as I read it, that seems to be kind of a parallel. They were supposed to be kind to the evildoers. Try to love them. There's other passages as you go on in Exodus chapter 23, verses 4 and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you should surely bring it back to him. This is somebody you don't like, but you're supposed to go out of your way to take his property back to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden, and you would refrain from helping him, you shall surely help him with it. Somebody that just has made it clear they don't like you. And you see that they've got an issue. In our vernacular, we don't generally see too many people going around, you know, leading a donkey or an ox. But what would might be a parallel? Somebody with a flat tire? Stop and help them. Even if it's somebody that you know and you know doesn't like you, if you stop and help them, you're doing a good, even though they may want to do you evil. You might, you know, sort of plant a seed of friendliness that in their heart, you may not, but that's not what God says. It doesn't say, you know, certify that that's good soil first before you plant the seed. He just says plant the seed.
Something I've struggled with is in the Psalms.
Okay.
David says, I hate those who hate you. And like Psalms 5:5 says, the arrogant cannot stand in your presence. You hate all who do wrong. And there's other
right,
Psalms passages like that. And I struggle with that.
A couple of ways that I look at some of those. These were written, some psalms, now we know that there's a lot, all scripture is given by inspiration. But does God truly hate workers of iniquity, or does he hate the iniquity? You know, but in our frame of reference, when we think of it, oftentimes we assign, and I think that's what David did, what a lot of people did, as we read, and what a lot of people do even today, is they take the hate evil, hate the sin, and they apply it to the sinner. There's a lot of areas. I'm going to use one for an example that's a buzz topic in our society today, homosexuality. How does God feel about homosexuality? He hates it. How does he feel about the homosexuals? He still loves them. He wants them to come to a proper knowledge of him, to obey him.
He still loves them, but what's he going to do to those that practice such things?
If they stop and they turn to him versus not. That's going to be the same as somebody that murders. That's going to be the same as somebody that steals and doesn't turn away from their
purpose. But when you go to the Psalms and look at scriptures like that, that's no relevance to the ruling under Jesus. If we look back at the time the Psalms was written, and God looked out and saw people that were doing something, he sent the Israelites down not only to kill all of them, but kill all their livestock and every living thing that's in their village. It was a different time. It was a different thing. And when you talk about the Jews and how they felt about the rest of the world, they were God's chosen people. And they were despised by the rest of the world because they came into the Middle East killing everybody they came across. And they sinned only when they didn't destroy everybody.
Well, they sinned when they turned away from God and started following
idols. They sinned when he said, kill every living thing. So, right. But I took these oxen,
yep.
They were the best.
Well, Saul did, yes, you're right.
Yeah.
But
that was the story of the Israelites back then. Boy, he's, you know, Jesus comes and says, I bring a new teaching. You've heard it said, yeah, everybody says, love your neighbor, hate your enemy. Everybody says that. That was from the beginning. But he said, I'm bringing new teaching. Don't just love those that love you. Love everybody so that they may see me through you.
Okay. I understand why you're saying that. I think God still loved even the people that were being destroyed. I think he was having them be destroyed because they had so turned away from him. That was their punishment being brought by God. Not that he hated them. He hated what they did, and they were receiving the punishment for what they did and how they behaved. Ed?
I think when you get right down to it, God's never changed. He's always been the same. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow. I think an example of where God even loved those who worked iniquity would be the book of Jonah, where God sent Jonah to preach to the city of Nineveh. And he told him, within so many days, you will be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Jonah didn't want to do that simply because Jonah was prejudiced. He hated the people who through prayer and repentance, the day of Jehovah, which had been proclaimed upon Nineveh, had been delayed. And there's other passages of scripture that show that God did not destroy the people until the cup of iniquity was full,
right,
when there was no more hope. And probably Romans chapter 1 and verse 18 would probably help in all these passages of scripture where he says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hinder the truth in unrighteousness."
Right.
So there's a possibility of why the judgment was so harsh upon those. Number one, to wipe out those who would influence the people of God. And number two, to let the people of God know that there are consequences for their sins.
Okay. And I didn't write down the passage, but that was even one of the things that in the Old Testament we read that God, I believe it was to Abraham, I'm not positive, said that basically the reason that God waited to take action or have Israel take action against the people in the land that Israel eventually inherited was because their iniquity was not yet full. So again, he was waiting, hoping, you know, but knowing that there would come a time when there was no more hope, that they were completely and totally turned against him. And so he did say, destroy everything. Don't save anything. For a few towns, he did that. Others, he said, you can keep the cattle. Some of them, he said, you can keep the women, you can keep the children. But some of them, he said, destroy everything. Everything that lives and breathes. And that's, as we get into love your enemies, Jesus says, I say to you, love your enemies, and he expounds on that. Just in case we're not sure. Bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Why? That you may be sons of your Father in heaven. And how does God treat evil and unjust people? He makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. So Jesus goes on then, he says, and he asks a couple of questions, he uses a couple of examples. He says, if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Don't even the tax collectors do that? What was the Jewish opinion of the tax collectors? Low. Why? They were considered traitors. They worked with the Roman government to impose taxes, to collect taxes from the people. And some, just like some businessmen today, not all, some businessmen today take a little extra that they don't necessarily need to take. And some of the tax collectors, I think that's the whole point of Zacchaeus' statement. If I've defrauded anybody, I'll give them back four times. It was one of the reasons I think that Jesus said to his apostles, to his disciples, by this all men will know you're my disciples if you love one another. Who was in that group of disciples? Matthew, who was a what? Tax collector. What was Simon? Simeon. A zealot. What was the goal of the zealots? Get rid of everybody that supported Rome. Here are two people that are as politically opposite as can be. And yet he's saying, if you two can love each other, now he doesn't say it just to them, he's just saying it to all of them. If you can love each other, that'll show people you're my disciples. People that are that different, if they can come together under me, that'll speak volumes. So Jesus says, there's, you know, what reward do you have if you act the same way the tax collectors do? You're no better than they are. That's kind of what he's saying. If you only do what they do, you're no better than they are. The Jews didn't want to hear that. They wanted to feel that they were better than the tax collectors. Think about the Pharisee in Luke chapter 18. 18 or 16? He said, I'm not like all these other people. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all I have. I'm better than they are. That's the attitude that a lot of the Pharisees wanted to have. And so when Jesus is saying, if you only love people that love you, you're no better than the tax collector. He's kind of going right in the face of that attitude, right in the face of that pridefulness. He goes on to say, even in greeting, if you greet your brethren, in the New King James it says your brethren only, some it says your family, some it says your brothers, what do you do more than others? Don't even the tax collectors do so? That's in the New King. It's in the New King James. In other translations, even the Gentiles. Okay. On the relative scale of they are so horrible, where did the Gentiles fall in relation to the tax collectors? Probably just a little lower. Why? Because the tax collectors at least were Jews. They were despised Jews by most of the population, but at least they were Jews. The Gentiles were considered even worse. What did the Jewish people consider? What did they call the Samaritans?
Dogs.
So here's Jesus saying, this attitude is going to have to change. Part of the new teaching that he's got. Part of, you can't just be prideful like Ed was pointing out with Jonah, who had a pride of nation. Hey, I'm part of Israel, and we're God's chosen people, and you guys aren't, so ha, ha, ha. And you know what? I don't want you to have anything good because you're not chosen. I mean, that was kind of the attitude. That's not the words he used, but that's kind of the attitude, because later on in chapter 4, he says, I didn't want to go because I know that you're a forgiving and loving God. I didn't want you to forgive them. I wanted you to bring the hammer down on them. That's not the words he used, but that's the idea. I don't want them to be treated well. That's the attitude that Jesus was dealing with in the Jewish people. The attitude that many of those people, probably most of those people, had toward non-Jews, non-Israelites. Jesus goes on to say, therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. Now, did Jesus suddenly change subjects from loving your neighbors to being sinless? Contextually, no. God has perfect love. He loves everybody. He doesn't always love what people do, but he loves the people. He wants everybody to be saved. He knows that not everybody will be, but he wants everybody to be. We are supposed to strive. If we are to be like God, if we're to be, and not, we're not going to be perfect, sinless people. But if we're going to strive for perfect love, there's steps we got to, that we got to think differently than the world, act differently than the world. I believe that the idea of loving your enemies is necessary and intrinsic in Jesus' teaching that goes back to the second mile. Don't retaliate. Why? Well, if you love them, you're not going to retaliate against them. You're going to do what's best for them if you have agape love for them. Remember, agape love is intentional love. Not because you have some kind of a warm, fuzzy feeling about them, you like hanging out with them, you like going fishing with them, watching TV with them, whatever. You want what's best for them. What's best for all people? Coming to a right relationship with God. Ultimately, that's what's best for all people. Jesus in John chapter 15, it's recorded in John chapter 15, if the world hates you, know that hated me before it hated you. In verse 20, if they persecuted me, they're going to persecute you. So Jesus is saying, don't be surprised if you get mistreated. It's going to happen. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7. Love suffers long. Some translations, love is patient. It's kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It's not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. Is not provoked. I think that goes to the whole don't retaliate concept. Thinks no evil. Does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in truth. Bears all things. Hopes all things. Believes all things. and endures all things. So remember that if Jesus is saying, if you love your enemies, you're going to find it a whole lot easier to not feel the need to get vengeance when they wrong you. So far, since we went through that first part and we got to the end where it said, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you'll by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Okay, Jesus said that. Then he goes on and he's got what I've gone through now here for the last several weeks, what I called contracts, talking about some of the teachings of the scribes and Pharisees. And Jesus is contrasting that with a better way. Either a more correct interpretation of those scriptures, and expounding on them so that the people that were hearing him then and the people that read about him today can understand a little better what he's talking about. He's going to go, as we go from chapter 5 into chapter 6, Jesus is going to go into from what they teach to what they do, or how they do it. Matthew chapter 6, verse 20 says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them, otherwise you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Charitable deeds here in the New King James is probably not the best translation. When you look at the Greek, the word that's there, it's I'm going to do my best to pronounce it. You can tell me maybe if I'm wrong there, Ed or Kurt, if you guys or anybody else that knows some of the Greek. Dikaiosunen or something like that, which basically is translated righteousness. So if we look at it that way, and I think some translations in the New American Standard, I think, has, take heed that you do not do your acts of righteousness before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Jesus is transitioning from, these are things that the scribes and Pharisees taught, here's a better way to look at those. Don't do like they do. Now, he says that in Matthew 23. He says, they sit in the Moses seat. Do what they say. Don't do what they do. And then he goes on at quite a length in Matthew chapter 23 about things that they do that are not right. So if we look at that, we see, well, that's the next at least three things that we're going to look at over the next couple of weeks. We'll hopefully finish one today, a couple more the next couple of weeks. Three different areas of righteousness that Jesus is going to address. Almsgiving, charitable deeds, charitable action, prayer, and fasting. Three things that he doesn't have a lot of praise for the scribes and Pharisees. It says, don't do it to be seen by men. What does he mean by that?
Well, back in that time when they would go into the temple.
Okay. Okay.
The brass and the top of it shaped like a spittoon or a trumpet. And they say you're going to give 20 bucks, they'd go down and get it all in nickels. And when they were going in, they'd drop it in that metal deal and they'd clank, 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 and make it sound like, boy, they were giving all kinds of money. And that was one of the habits that they did back then, so that the people around would think, boy, look how generous and wonderful they are for giving lots of money.
Okay.
We're not doing these acts out of love.
Okay.
Even to this day, the Jewish people still do this sort of thing. I just was invited here a few years ago to an old boss I had that was Jewish, and they were throwing a big dinner, bank, whatever you call it, accomplishments of Gerald Murfish, mm-hmm. You know, all this, you come and you pay money to go for the tickets. He's the one that was putting it on.
All right.
I mean, he was the one that put it on. How wonderful I am. Come by the tickets and come and praise me.
Right.
When United Way, any kind of thing like that, oh, you had to do it because they had to go down and the city would give you a certificate. Oh, that was it. And they put it up on their wall. And it was all about the public adulation for what they had done. And they didn't care anything about what they were accomplished.
Okay.
And I found that through that, still to this day, through that old community. Say anything against it,
Well, and the thing is, if you look back at Matthew chapter 5 and verse 16, what's Jesus say? Let your light so shine before men that they may, what?
See your good deeds.
See your good deeds and what?
And glorify your Father.
And glorify your Father. They're going to see your good deeds, not all the things. Jesus isn't saying, don't do good things in public. He's saying, don't do good things to be seen, speaking to motive, speaking to motivation, to be seen by men, kind of what Bruce was talking about. You know, if you don't care less about who you're giving to, you just want the, wow, they gave a lot. What comes to my mind? Liberty Telephone. The huge checks. This corporation's given $25,000, $250,000 to MBA, whatever. Did they care about? Maybe a little bit. But what did they really care about? People go, oh, we got to go support 7-Eleven. We got to go support that company because they're so generous and do so much good. So, we can't always hide our deeds. Jesus goes on to say, when you do a charitable deed, don't sound a trumpet. Don't make a lot of noise about it. Don't announce yourself before you as hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. I tell you, or assuredly, or some translations, truly, truly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret. Your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you. New King James says openly. How can I do something and not know? A couple of thoughts on that. One, it becomes such a habit pattern that when you do something good for somebody, we're not talking about just, here's money. Doing nice things for people, holding the door open, whatever. I mean, the list could be extremely long of things, nice deeds, good deeds that you do. Stopping to help somebody that's run out of gas, taking them to a gas station in the back of their car, giving somebody helping somebody change a flat tire. Again, the list could go on and on and on and on. And you just get to be where you just do it. You don't even think about it. Left hand doesn't even know what the right hand's doing. You're just doing it. And you're not thinking in advance. How much was that? I mean, I need to make sure I can claim that on my taxes. Now, that's sort of doing to be seen by men, even if not a whole lot of people see how much you're writing. You're still making sure you get credit for it. That's one way of looking at that. There's an interesting additional way of looking at that that was put forward by Richard Linsky. He was a German-born American naturalized Bible scholar that lived born in the late 1800s and died in the mid 20th century. He said, the right hand represents me with the good deeds that I do. The left hand represents me with the good opinion I have about myself, about the things I do. Kind of what he's kind of saying is, in the don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing is, don't let what you do, the good things that you do, go to your head. Don't get so prideful and full of yourself because of things that you do. Jesus mentions two sources of reward. He says in verse 1, if you do your deeds to be seen by men, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. So one source of reward is God. Another source of reward he mentions is they may have glory from men. Assuredly I say, they got their reward. So basically what your person needs to weigh out in their heart, do we want the recognition and accolades and glory from men that's going to be here today and gone tomorrow? Or, as 2 Corinthians 5:10, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body according to what he's done, whether good or bad. We're going to be judged. God's going to look at it. The rewards that we could have in heaven, one, just being in the presence of God for all eternity. I mean, that's a pretty big reward. And if we have love for our enemies, and we're doing good deeds so frequently that we just do them without even thinking about them. We are laying up, I believe, for ourselves, treasures in heaven. We're going to get to that a few weeks from now when we look at that later on in chapter 6. As Jesus says this, in verse 2 he said, therefore, if you do a charitable deed, no, when you do a charitable deed. Jesus assumes they and we are going to do charitable deeds. We're going to do good things when you do them, not if you do them. He says that when you do them, have the right attitude, have the right motivation, or the reward you get is going to be passing. Kelly?
Isn't it interesting how Jesus can be so easy to understand, and yet I may be the only one in here, but I'm a mixed up motivator person. I mean, there's things that I do to truly glorify God, and somehow there's a weed grown in that of myself and what I want men to see, a little weed growing in the good plant that I'm wanting to give to God, and I can't extricate the two. You know, the human condition is an incredibly complicated thing, the human motivation.
Right.
And I am so glad that Jesus is who he is, because, you know, for me, I'm not even the only one. Sometimes I can't figure it out so very black and white. Why am I doing this?
Sometimes one of the things that I recognize in, I would say, majority of people who do something, there's not too many people that would be upset if you came up and said, Virgil, that was a great thing you did. You know, Virgil wouldn't be upset about that if he was acknowledged. And Jesus isn't saying that you're not going to get acknowledged. He's saying don't do it to be acknowledged. If, again, it goes back to motivation. And like you said, Kelly, sometimes that's very hard. I believe that as we look at the Sermon on the Mount, we're looking at Jesus saying, this is what the perfect picture looks like. And guess what? I'm human. I'm not perfect. I'm going to stumble. Some of the things we've already talked about, I struggle with. Some of the things we're going to talk about, I really struggle with. But that doesn't mean that all hope is lost. Troy?
In this whole discussion about doing things and the motivation for why you do them, and being rewarded or acknowledged or observed by other people for what you're doing, is there some aspect of this where you could be doing good and maybe intentionally let somebody else know about it to encourage them?
I suppose that's you, if you're trying to encourage somebody else to do good things.
Some of this is not as clear-cut as we would like to.
Right, exactly.
And as a parent, if you do something for somebody and take the kid,
you're trying to teach them to do good.
You know, you're showing them what you do, what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're not taking them along so you know they can say, well, gee, my daddy's a good guy.
Yeah.
So,
again,
more than one way to consider some of these things.
Well, and that's part of, I believe, what Jesus is saying is when you do your acts of righteousness, the motivation that's in your heart is almost paramount, more important than what you did. But when you do something good, when you do a good deed, when you do give money to charity, don't make a big deal. Don't personally make a big deal about it. If your kids see you give money to a homeless man, later on you can use that as a teaching moment and say, you know, I'm trying to help somebody, or buy him a sandwich, or, you know, those kinds of things. Bruce?
I think you're absolutely right. It's talking about the motivation in your heart. But he brings up a good point, because just not long ago, it's funny you should say, because I was sitting here thinking about it. I know some people who were talking about some people about, oh, look at them, they don't ever do anything, and how greedy and tight they are. And I happen to know for a fact that those people do a tremendous
But Jesus says, if you do it in what?
In his name.
If you do it in secret, you're not tooting a horn about, hey, look at me, look what I'm doing. You're doing it in secret. Who sees that?
God
sees it. He sees he sees what's in your heart.
And then these people, you know, they did it because they loved the people. They weren't, mm-hmm. they weren't living for it.
Right.
But the recipients of that looked back the other way, and they were like, wow.
And it makes you go, really?
It's like, don't you know what they're doing? Yeah. I mean, if they really paid attention, it's obvious.
Right. Well, I appreciate your participation and attention during class. Next week, we'll talk about prayer. And keep in mind, that could be a class that could go on for a whole couple months, but we're going to try to keep it to one class period.